There continues to be a great deal of sniking at the GNU by black political activists, all of whom say that it's basically a sellout to the whites. And of course, this is an attack on Ramaphosa at the same time. The SACP has said that the GNU is class suicide, but most of the criticism are phrased in racial terms as sellout to the whites. And this critical opinion is so widely expressed by ANC activists that somebody like Blade and Nzimande says that, quote, just about everyone in the ANC is opposed to the GNU. Now, the first point I want to make is that this is not true at all. Proof of this came in October 24, just 4 months after the formation of the GNU, when the first poll came out about it. By 60% to 28%, the voters thought that the ANC was doing well in the government of national unity, and an even bigger majority said the DA was. It was a highly favourable impression, and both the ANC and the DA had actually picked up support, 4 or 5% more than in the election, as a result. And at the same time, both the EFF and the MKP had fallen. So there'd been a clear and net transfer from the left to the centre, or whatever you want to call it. So this, at mass level, there was no doubt at all that the opinion of the GNU was positive. And those findings were quickly confirmed by a second survey by the Institute of Race Relations. And they asked them, do you prefer this government or the ANC government that was in place before? And by 63 to 29, they said, we prefer the GNU to an ANC government. Note the 29, because we've since had this figure of the ANC at 32. I think that figure is quite interesting. There's only that group which is hardline ANC. It's diminished already. They then asked people, well, how about, would you prefer a government of the ANC, EFF, MKP, or the GNU you've got? And the answer to that was 52 to 27, saying we prefer the GNU. So almost 2-1. Now, that's mass opinion. This is not activists. I may say that there was other data in that survey too, which backed that up, but I won't go through all of it. Now, it is true that among ANC activists, and let's concentrate very clearly on that word activists, because it's very important to differentiate between them and the mass following of the ANC. It is true that among ANC activists, there is a very strong anti-GNU sentiment. Indeed, the Secretary General, Fikile Mbalula, says the ANC pretty much hates the GNU. But of course, in his job, he mixes only with activists. Now, it's worth just thinking about this distinction I'm making between the activists and the mass opinion of the ANC. Because I think more than any other party I know, and I'm a political scientist and I've studied political parties all my life, there is a much bigger gap between those two groups than is at all normal. And I think the reason is historical. That when the ANC went into exile in Britain, Zambia, and so on, it consisted only of activists, by definition. There were a few thousand people. And for the next 30 years, that was the ANC. And the leadership got used to just talking to activists. There was no mass following. Now, when they came back in 1990, what happened? The mass following just appeared immediately. Now, it's not like an ordinary political party where you have to go out and slog away for years and gradually build up branches and so on. This mass following just volunteered itself. On day one, it was there. Now, I think that as a result of this, the leadership of the ANC has continued to talk mainly to activists, and that they don't really know much about their own mass following. And I think that that is still the activist world is still a closed circle to a considerable extent. And the leadership, I think that you could tell in the last election, right up until the election day, Ramaphosa and the others all insisted they were going to win over 50%. They didn't know what their mass following was thinking and doing, quite clearly. Now, the key point to realize is that the last elections were an absolute disaster for ANC activists. There was a huge loss of parliamentary and provincial seats, which meant large numbers of people suddenly without salaries, without expense accounts, and without the multiple opportunities for corruption offered by elected office. So tremendous loss of patronage. And of course, this always has a wider fallout because with the ANC only down 40-odd percent, suddenly all the businesses that have been thinking of getting people on their boards who were going to be ANC would say, well, maybe not. Maybe we don't bother with that. So there would be that sort of extra effect as well. And just like nothing succeeds like success, the same is true in reverse. Now, of course, the activists are the most ideological group, and they tend to react in ideological terms. But at heart, the ANC is a patronage-based party. And the point is that after the 24 election, patronage was in very short supply. And that intensified the competition for jobs and opportunities among that activist group, which was very unpleasant for them. Moreover, with the ANC losing power in KZN and doing badly across the country, there were thousands and thousands of ANC municipal councillors who could see only too well that they were likely to go down the tubes before long. So those two are all feeling the cold wind. So there's no doubt at all that from the activist point of view, the 24 election was the worst news they'd ever had because the loss of patronage was so big. Now, of course, that doesn't affect or make any impact upon the mass following who are not MPs or councillors or whatever. Just how bitter the competition is as a result of that is well shown by the example of water. If you look at what happened in after 94, in most municipalities, water affairs were put under charge of a sort of one unit. So there was one guy who was director of water affairs or whatever, and he was in charge and he ran it and he collected the water rates and he did what was necessary and so forth. And that all worked pretty well. But the problem was that throughout the country, ANC politicians realized that water rates were a major revenue stream. And they wanted to get their hands on it. So, of course, what they did in one municipality after another was to get hold of the water jobs and divert that money to far more interesting uses, which I needn't go into with you, and had very little to do with water. Now, this was realized, and as we know, water has become a major problem area. And one result of this was that it was decided by many municipalities that they ought to go back to what they'd had in 94 and have one unit with one person clearly responsible and in charge. And so this change was made back in a number of municipalities. But of course, the problem about that was that that meant that the revenue stream, which had been flowing into the pockets of various ANC politicians, was now diverted back where it should have gone in the first place. Now, in the case of Bloemfontein, Mangoan, and Buffalo City, East London. In both those cases, the man put back in charge of water affairs was assassinated very quickly. This is what real competition does over patronage, okay? You know how it works. Now, the squeeze on patronage is articulated in ideological terms and often in bluntly racial terms. And of course, this is something ANC activists share with the EFF and the MKP because the GNU is keeping them out of power too and out of patronage opportunities. So they feel it very bitterly as well. So they have that in common. So it's no wonder that there are links between those three groups. There are plenty of people in the ANC who would like to get together with EFF and MKP. They all feel the same about that. But it's quite clear that that activist group, one thing I thought was quite funny, which was that after 100 days of the GNU, the DA held a celebration because they were feeling very happy about it. And of course, the ANC felt they'd better do the same. So they held their own 100 days of the GNU celebration. And almost nobody came because the activists did not feel like celebrating it still. Now, to go back to this question of the divide between the activists and the mass following, I did a lot of work in the 1990s with Lawrence Schlemmer, who I think was the best analyst of opinion, mass opinion, that we've had in this country. A wonderful chap. And he was director of Mark Data. And he alerted me almost immediately that I got back to the country and said, look, you know, it's really a very interesting situation that when you ask people questions about, are you happy with the ANC government? They say yes. But then if you ask further, they'll say, well, actually, it would be good if the government could work together with business or work together with the wider community. Phrases like that. And something like 2/3 of all voters expressed those sentiments. So there was an appetite, even within the ANC mass electorate, from the very beginning, saying it would be better if the ANC worked together effectively with the whites and the business community. Now, Laurie probed that a great deal, and despite all the negative racial stereotypes created by apartheid, the truth was that what he found was that there was a large silent majority of black respondents who were quite well aware of the white contribution in making South Africa the most developed country in Africa. And they were keen to retain the advantages of that, of being living in such a country. And they would ideally like the government to be supported by the expertise, know-how, and capital of the white community. That's what it meant to say they would like to have the wider community and the business community and so forth. And indeed, there was a degree of nervousness about how a black government would fare if they didn't have that support. Now, of course, those opinions were at odds with the ANC government and certainly with Thabo Mbeki. I don't know whether you remember, but quite early on in Thabo's time, when he was president, the business community offered to lend him 1,000 of their best managers, saying you could use them any way you want, but you need really good managers to do the things you want. Now, instead of being pleased, he was furious and saw this as white arrogance and wouldn't speak to them for years on end as a result, because he actually reacted very badly to that. But in fact, of course, his view of things was not at all typical of that mass feeling. It was the opposite, really. And the interesting thing is, and I remember Laurie taking me through the figures when I first arrived back, he's saying, look, you know, it's curious because the dominant group, ANC leadership, tends to be atheist, agnostic, and it tries to have progressive views about all sorts of things. But the ANC mass electorate is quite conservative. It deplores the abolition of the death penalty. It doesn't like abortion. Generally homophobic. It's quite patriarchal. And it's often xenophobic. These are not at all the attitudes approved of at the top level. And so what you've got is a left-wing party leading a majority, which is mainly Christian conservative. Moreover, if you ask, this is something I've noticed when I started doing opinion survey work in the middle 90s. I was struck by it then, but it's remained absolutely true throughout and is true today, is that mass opinion, including ANC mass opinion, is strongly against affirmative action. It believes that you should have the best person for the job and that only merit counts. These are people who suffer the consequences if you put the wrong people in charge. And they know. And it's not at all controversial among the mass electorate. It's always been like that. Now, the interesting thing is that the most striking case of this is the land issue. As you know, whether you're talking about EFF or MKP or ANC, the leadership love going on about land and hence expropriation and so forth. It's always the most emotive issue. But when we ask voters at large which issues are important to them, land usually comes out between 2% and 3%. It's way, way down. Doesn't matter at all compared to unemployment. And to the great distress of the ANC leadership, when African groups win their case and get the right to land, they always prefer the money. They don't actually want the land. The real hunger for land is housing land near and in big cities. That's what the real hunger is for, not for agricultural land. Now, Laurie and I often used to discuss this situation and say, how do we understand this? And I remember saying to him, you know, it's like Portugal, because Portugal was, in 1974, it was taken over by a left-wing group of officers who were really pretty left-wing, quite Marxist. And yet the truth was that Portugal was a country with a very strong Catholic Church, a very Catholic peasantry, a conservative middle class which had supported Salazar. I mean, there was this huge divide between the leadership and what looked like mass opinion in that country. And I said, but, you know, it couldn't last. And, of course, it didn't. And fairly quickly, Portugal reverted to the sort of standard European type where you get alternation between social democrats and Christian democrats. And there's no sign of that extreme left. And, you know, I said, maybe it'll be the same in South Africa because we've got this tremendous divide between leadership and mass group and so on. And we used to debate this because we weren't at all sure, because on the other side was the popularity of populist economic notions and, of course, the fact of high unemployment, which could radicalize people. And it was very difficult because we realized that on the one hand, the end of apartheid had unleashed very, very strong pressures for African advancement. And often that hunger for advancement did not recognize the necessity of the educational criteria necessary for that advancement, which was a great weakness. But the point was that on the one hand, we had a situation where there was this huge pressure for advancement, and at the same time, those aspirations were being crushed by poverty and mass unemployment. So it was really, we were never sure what our answer to that question was. And of course, the other thing is that the electoral system in this country gives the party elites the power to impose their choices and their discipline and their perspective on the masses, and they choose the candidates and so on. And that muffles the voices from below. Now, I think that the polling that we did in 2024, of course, the ANC tried hard to shift the blame for mass unemployment onto white monopoly capital, but that did not work. And we found in all our surveys that the failures of ANC governments, the power cuts, the water cutoffs, etc., they were blaming the ANC. They just didn't accept that it was white monopoly capital at all. Secondly, although the idea of coalition was new to voters, we did, in the course of the campaign, say, what are your opinions about coalition government? And a lot of voters didn't know because they were unsure about the whole idea. But we then said, okay, if there is a coalition, which party would you most like the ANC to form a partnership with? And the number one choice was always the DA. It was quite clear, and that was before the election took place, before they knew that it was going to happen. So I'm not really surprised at the popularity at mass level of the GNU, because it was embryonically there even before the election. And as I say, it was there embryonically back in the 1990s when people were saying they wanted a broader community and the business community to be involved with government as well. Now, as we know, at the moment, the left alternative to this has faded. The SACP is weaker, COSATU is weaker, the EFF is having a bad time, and the NKP has also fallen back a bit. And it's not clear what their future is there. But what is true, as we look towards the future, is it would appear that even the anti-GNU left-wingers have decided to go along with Ramaphosa until 27, simply because he's more popular and it's clear from the polling data that the ANC does better with him as leader. So a lot more MPs and councillors will keep their jobs if Ramaphosa is at the head of the ticket. And I'm sure that will be a powerful argument for them to want to keep him there. But the point that I want to make is that the future of the GNU is quite clearly going to become entangled with the succession race within the ANC. And you can look at the contest which is building up. Now, on the one hand, Paul Mashatile, Panyaza Lesufi, and Kosi Enso Ramakopa, the Minister for Electricity, those are all possible presidential candidates. They're all members of the SACP. Okay? The ones who are candidates who are not members of the SACP are Ronald Omola, Minister of Justice, Senzo Mchunu, Minister of Police, doing a rather good job there, and indeed Fikile Mbalula. So you've got three on each side. Now, the ANC has made it clear, sorry, the DA has made it clear that they would not support Mashatile as president. And I would assume that they would feel the same about any other SACP candidate. So I think that the succession race, the big question is it going to be an SACP person or non-SACP? I think because if it's non-SACP, then the GNU could continue. But if there is an SACP, I think it would break down. Now, the key thing to realize here is that the ANC conference to choose leaders, let us be frank, it's an auction. That is exactly what it is. Money changes hands. It was about 10,000 per constituency party last time. It'll be more next time. I don't think there's any way of stopping this. And it's well ingrained. And if you ever talk to people who are delegates going to these conferences, they do expect to come back with their pockets full of money. And they usually do. And what happened last time was that Zuma arrived at the conference well prepared with a great deal of money from the Guptas and a great deal more from SOEs and some BEE types and so forth. And he was extremely confident of winning because, of course, he knew that world of ANC fundraising to a T. He was very good at knowing everything, you know, in detail about that sort of thing. And he knew perfectly well that there was nobody else who could possibly raise that sort of money and so forth. But of course, what had happened was that Ramaphosa had gone campaigning among white businessmen and had collected a great deal of money. And in the end, Ramaphosa outbid him. That is exactly what happened. Zuma spent a hell of a lot of money and still lost. Now, the minute he lost, he knew what must have happened, because he knew that the world that he came from could not possibly have given Ramaphosa that amount of money. So from that moment on, he has attacked Ramaphosa as the candidate of white monopoly capital. And you can see why. Now, the point really to get is this, is that, oh, by the way, notice that in the NKP, Zuma has said he doesn't want to have party conferences because they're only going to be settled with money. He's lost once that way. He doesn't want to happen again. Now, I think if we think about the ANC succession race, we have to think about this, because I've no doubt that Paul Mashatile has the ability to marshal large sums of money from the same sort of sources that Zuma got his. So the question really is, will the successor to Ramaphosa on the non-SACP side, whether it's Lamola or Juno, I don't think Mbalula will last the race, frankly. I think it'll more likely at this stage to be those two. Will they be able to marshal the same support from white business that Ramaphosa did? Because I think that's what it'll come down to. Now, the trouble is that this time all the moves are known in advance. Okay? We've been through this once before. And Zuma is still politically active, and I think it's quite likely that he will try to intervene at the ANC conference. He may even get more money from the Guptas to do so. They're still there in Dubai, and I'm sure he still has good contacts with them. But equally, there's no doubt that at the last election, his party got a lot of money from the Russians. No doubt about that at all. They even had T-shirts with Putin's face on them. That doesn't happen by accident. Usually the T-shirt had Putin and Zuma as sort of two comrades together. But, I mean, I was struck, you know, even down in the Western Cape, MKP made an effort down here, and they had 4x4s, and they had lots of money, and they were spending like crazy. Now, they didn't get many votes for it, but there was no doubting the resources behind that party. Now, all of this will make it harder for Lamola or Mchunu, because it'll be perfectly clear. I'm sure the business community will want the GNU to continue. They've been very important in Operation Vulindlela. They'll want that to go on. But the situation is highly problematic because this is the one occasion in which the white business community becomes a major player in ANC politics. I mean, a decisive player last time. Now, it could happen again, but if it does, everyone will know where the money came from. I think it's problematic. But I think at the moment, that's what it's going to depend on. So I'll stop there.
Every time I get one of your contributions, Bill, it opens my eyes. And I feel like I've been given another lesson today in the naivety that we have. I think most South Africans would believe that when you go into an ANC, whoever is going to be your president is there on merit, that they've got the support of the parties. And to hear in the very simple terms that you unpacked it, that it's an auction, that it really isn't anything else, would be quite a shock to the system. It brings me to what Rob Herzog is trying to do with people from abroad, bringing in rich, wealthy South Africans from abroad to perhaps counterbalance those who have been funding on the ANC side. Do you think that's a smart idea?
Sorry, is what a smart idea?
Bringing money from wealthy South Africans abroad to fund DA, PA, etc.
Well, I think the DA has every right to canvass for support wherever it wants, financially or otherwise. So I see no problem with that.
But where I'm going here is, if the one party is playing like a street fighter and the other party is playing according to the rules, i.e. the DA reporting what it gets in, where it gets it in from, clearly the money that came in for the Ramaphosa and the Zuma campaigns were never disclosed in a way that they should have been. It's not a fair fight, but is it a fight that can be won?
Well, it's just the way things are. I don't expect that to change easily. Look, it does seem to me very likely that the ANC got a lot of money from Iran in order to take the case to the ICJ. But they certainly didn't register any donation. And if you think of it, that money must have come in cash, because which is illegal, of course. But that's the one way you can hide it. It doesn't have to go through any bank accounts or whatever. You can simply distribute it. And as I say, the maximum amount you're supposed to get is 10 million, but they must have got an awful lot more than that, because they were bankrupt when they got, that was December 23. Suddenly they paid off their debts, and they also had 6 months back salaries to pay to ANC officials. And they paid that off too. And then they had no more financial troubles for the rest of 24. They've started again now, but for the rest of 24, and that included a very expensive election campaign. So they must have had hundreds of millions from Iran to do all of that.
What are the consequences of accepting that money?
Well, the consequence, I think, was that the ANC agreed to take the case to the ICJ. I think that was the deal.
But the consequences for South Africa, if
they're not good at all, as we know. But that's the way the cookie crumbles.
Are there any parallels in history, in political history, of parties that have received this kind of funding?
Oh, look, party funding is a dubious matter, and always has been. I spend a lot of my life doing French politics, and certainly it was always very dodgy. The Gaullist Party had a particularly special relationship with Dassault, the maker of the Mirage and Rafale and so forth. And they got big, big bucks from them. But they always had this special relationship with France-Afrique, and particularly Gabon. So a lot of Gabon oil money used to flow into the coffers of the... And it was always, dirty money, couldn't be acknowledged. Everyone would deny it, but, it was happening. And Sarkozy was getting money from Gaddafi, which is a pretty dirty money. So, this is not too surprising. It happens in other countries, sure.
So we the people who look at this and don't first of all know that it's happening, but if we do, we think, oh, that's a conspiracy. Now R.W. Johnson says it's happening. Okay, I get it. I understand. What can you do about it?
What can you do about what? About dirty
what
money?
What can we, the people, what can normal voters, what can the public, members of the BizNews tribe sitting here, what can and should they do about these horrific things that you've outlined for us?
Well, sorry, the dirty money side of things.
And the political assassinations on top of it, driven by dirty money.
Well, I don't think we can do a great deal. truthfully, I think that these things do go on, and not only in this society, but in others. And it's very difficult to stop them. All you can do is try to expose what is going on. And I mean, that's the game in a country like France. Journalists forever trying to peel back what's going on. And of course, it has been successful to some degree. Sarkozy's on trial again now. And the guy who got away with it more or less completely was Chirac. And, you know, it was very surprising to me in the last French presidential election, where an old friend of mine was exposed for having basically got a chateau with dirty money and was forced out of the presidential race, which I was rather sorry about. He was a nice chap, but he was taking dirty money. There's no doubt about it. Look, I don't think that there's much we can do, except in the political parties that we support, we can make sure that that doesn't happen in those parties. But we can't. It's very difficult for me to say how I'm going to stop the ANC from getting support from dubious people abroad. I don't see how I can.
But there is a lot of geopolitics going on now. There is an American administration who may look at things differently.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. And as I pointed out in the last article I did for you, I think the ANC has been very naive about the intelligence situation that, you know, if the Americans want to know things, they have ways of finding out which will not have occurred to this government. And, you know, I mean, they have keyhole satellites, which, I mean, I've seen the stuff myself. And I mean, this is from 1980s. The keyhole satellite could take photographs from space where you could see a man on a street corner in Minsk and you could read the headlines on his newspaper from space. Think about that. But equally, think about communication satellites, which can suck up all electronic communications, including telephone calls and so on. And the NSA, the National Security Agency, have got the best decrypting people in the world, so they can crack any encrypting which goes on. So, you know, frankly, their ability to get to the bottom of these things will be very much greater than we are used to in this country. So it'll be very interesting. I mean, they're going to try and find out, I gather, about the Iran-South Africa link, and I would be surprised if they don't find out quite a lot.
Doesn't that put a different complexion on the comments that Donald Trump has been making about South Africa, if he is presumably well-informed?
I doubt whether, look, in his first term, Trump refused to read the intelligence briefing, which he gets every day. He simply doesn't read. I don't think he's read a book hardly in his life. You know, he sits looking at Fox TV. He gets his opinions from that and from conversation with people, and then fires from the hip. And so I doubt whether that, unless someone's told him, I mean, that's the way he would learn, so if someone who did have that information came and told him. But I doubt whether that's already happened. I think they've only started looking at the Iran-South Africa links recently. But that will happen. You know, the Jewish lobby is very strong on Capitol Hill, and they've been pushing this for a while, so I'm sure that that will happen.
What are the consequences for South Africa if what is rumored about the ANC taking money from Iran is proved to be true?
Well, it would simply, increase American wrath. I mean, after all, Iran is a rogue state. It openly supports terrorist movements. It openly says that it wants to sort of get rid of America, get rid of Israel, wipe the Israelis off the map, and so on. They're in a complete confrontation over the nuclear issue. And so, you know, acting as a proxy for them is about as low as you can go in American opinion. And that would be true not only among Republicans, you know.
Bill, before we go to the audience questions, the picture that you've painted for us is the world as it is, not the world as maybe we would want it to be. Is there any bright side to all of this?
Well, I think the bright side is simply the fact that African mass opinion is not as hostile to the GNU. It's actually positive about the GNU, and that those people here who share those feelings, I mean, you're all perfectly typical of mass opinion, including in the ANC. So that there is much more of a national consensus there than has realized. And people don't realize that because it's the ANC activists who tend to get the headlines and make the noise and so forth. But if you actually probe mass opinion, the situation is a great deal more comfortable for the GNU than you might have thought. That to me is quite a bright side.
It is profound. Andrew Van Dam asks, if the ANC hadn't included Cassato et al. From the start, how long would they have lasted? Was it actually legal or constitutional, or did they miss an opportunity by maybe excluding the trade unions?
Sorry, I don't understand that question.
The question was, if the ANC hadn't included COSATU, the SACP, in other words, the Tripartite Alliance, from the start, would it have made much difference?
Oh, yes, I think so, because, look, the SACP has been their brains trust. If you go back to 94, I mean, you still had then a really quite talented white Jewish intellectuals group, Slova at the head of it, but quite a number of others too, who were very influential in the party. And many of those guys are pretty smart. And mind you, the smartest of all was Ruth First. It wasn't a guy at all. The SACP did bring certain weight to that alliance. But of course, those people are no longer there. It brings very little now. But nonetheless, it's got people in high positions in COSATU and ANC and the various front organizations, you know, SANCO and things like that. So they're still in a very strong position in that sense. But so, if the ANC were really to part company from the SACP, there would be a lot of trouble within that movement. There's no doubt, because there are many SACP people in very powerful positions who could make life very difficult for them.
Lisa Sherd asks, how do you break patronage politics? What conditions should prevail for this to happen?
Oof. Well, it's very difficult. Look, patronage is part of all politics, ultimately. If you take the House of Commons in Britain, you get a minister, he appoints a junior minister, and finally a PPS, a parliamentary private secretary. Now, these are patronage appointments, you know, and you get powerful ministers who have their own protégés who they're bringing on behind them and who will loyally support them and so forth. That's always been so. It's still so. And you will find things like that in most political systems. And of course, it can be much more crude than that as well. I mean, it was something which, when Lyndon Johnson was the majority leader in the U.S. Senate, he, of course, would get a lot of Texas oil money, which helped him win his races and so forth. But after a while, he went to the Texas oil barons and said, I could help you a lot more than I'm doing. And they said, how? And he said, give me more money. And of course, what he would then do is, when it came to elections, Lyndon Johnson would go to this Democratic senator and that one and give them $1 million or $500,000 or whatever, which would make all the difference in their campaign. And they, of course, would owe him. And so when Johnson wanted their votes, he got them. And he wasn't necessarily buying them any straightforward way, but it was a patronage system, you know, no doubt about it. So I would say patronage is universal, but of course there are degrees to which it works. I mean, it would be ridiculous to say that the British system is a patronage-based system. It's not really. Patronage exists within that system, but, you know, it's not that powerful. Look, it's very difficult. I mean, Italian politics works almost entirely on patronage. And the further south you go, the more true that is. But, I mean, down in Sicily or whatever, you know. But the Mezzogiorno. I think that, look, the only thing that you could do is if a party loses power, then, of course, it loses most of its patronage, more or less by definition. And already the ANC has lost a lot of it, but if it actually lost power, then it would lose almost all of its patronage, and then they would have to live without it, at least for a while they were out of power. So, I mean, that's the way that changes take place.
The question here from Mr. Alex was, the five parties that Rob Persoff mentioned, what would they have to do to win the next general election? There he's talking about the DA, IFP, PA, Freedom Front Plus, and ACDP.
Well, I don't see that there's any magic formula. They'll all try their best, undoubtedly. But, you know, they are limited by the things we know. There's no magic formula.
But appealing to the conservative Christian values.
Oh, I see. Well, that's not actually what elections are about, is it, on the whole? We don't fight elections in this country based on religion. That's probably a good thing. But I do think it's true that there must be ways of getting to some of those voters, particularly since, look, the thing that's clear from all the latest polls is the fluidity of the African vote. You know, that just after the GNU was formed, the ANC rose back up to sort of 45, 47. It's now down to 32. I mean, just think, I mean, that's 15% of the electorate in no time. And there must be an awful lot of discontented, disillusioned people, completely unsure of what to do. And obviously, a great deal depends on who can get to them. Look, as things stand, you would have to favor the ANC as getting to them. I mean, that's the party they're used to. They've got some historic connection to. They will try very hard to pull them back. But certainly for the other parties, that's the target group, no doubt about it. And there are an awful lot of them now, and the numbers may well increase. And particularly, sorry, let me just finish that thought. Look, the municipal elections could be particularly bad for the ANC for obvious reasons. They've made such a mess in all the metros and indeed in other towns as well, like Pietermaritzburg, which may not be a metro, but boy, it's a mess. And, you know, they're going to get the blame quite rightly for the cuts, water, electricity and so on. And so I think, you know, the likelihood is that they're going to, that the number of discontented voters is going to increase. Of course, what's been happening largely is people abstain. So the number of actual voters keeps falling at every election. So I expect that to continue. But nonetheless, there will be an awful lot of don't knows, and they have to be appealed to on some basis.
Dirk van der Walt wants to know, on Trump, if not Trump, then whom and what else? What is the reason that you can't say anything positive about Donald Trump? Why so exceedingly resolute against Trump? Why not a nuanced position?
Talking about me now. Well, I think he's a big child. You know, what he's doing with tariffs is completely irrational and illogical. Looks like he's going to cause a recession in America. And you watch out for the opinion polls then, my God. He could become very unpopular very quickly. You know, I don't see look, it's true that there are some things that Trump does which probably a lot of us feel sympathy with. I certainly think that some of the sort of anti-woke stuff I can't but sympathize with. Personally, I've never really liked affirmative action. I do prefer merit appointment or on whatever thing we're talking about. So I'm not at all sorry to see that go. And equally DEI, diversity, etc. I'm perfectly happy to see that go. So I don't mind some of those things. But overall, his overall policy and the crassness, I mean, you know, deliberately enraging and upsetting the Canadians, his very nice neighbors. What on earth does he think he's going to do with that? I mean, it's absurd. But he is also very, very ignorant. I mean, start with the fact, if you think of Canada, Canada's much bigger than America, much. I mean, Canada's the second biggest country in the world. Only Russia is bigger. If Canada were to join America, it wouldn't be one state, right? You've got 13 provinces for a start and several territories after that. So it would be at least half a dozen states, maybe more. And they'd all vote Democratic. So the Republicans would be very sorry if that happened. I mean, he hasn't thought that through. But anyway, be that as it may, he doesn't read. You know, what can I say?
Jacques Poupart says, what's your opinion on Prince Mashele's assertion that the GNU will dissolve in 2028?
Sorry, the GNU will...
will dissolve. It'll end in 2028.
What will it result?
Prince Mashele's assertion. He said yesterday that the GNU will be over in 2028 because of the election... the electoral election in the ANC in 2027.
Well, it could well be right because, you know, Ramaphosa's likely term will finish in 27. And as I said, everything then depends on the succession struggle in the ANC. So depending on who comes through there, if it's Mashatile, then I think that's the end of the GNU. Sure. So, I mean, it just depends on that, I think. But also, sorry, can I just finish that?
Yeah.
Look, it also depends. The DA keeps saying, quite rightly, that the test of the GNU is whether they can achieve growth and bring down unemployment. And I agree, that's the crucial thing. Now, if they get to 28 and they haven't done that, then I think the GNU fails in its own right then.
We'll close off with the question here from Mark Thompson, who says, where does the SACP power base come from, and is it disproportionately represented within the ANC?
Yes, it is disproportionately represented in the sense that it's got far more people at top level or near top level in the ANC and COSATU and SANCO and so forth than it ought to have in terms of its mass support. Sure, that's true. They've been very, very good at picking off people at that level. Rather like Freemasons in a way. And of course, you know, there is this strange comparison that under the National Party, you had the Bruderbond, a secret or more or less secret society, which was at the inner part of the party calling the shots. And the SACP performing exactly the same role within the ANC. And again, a sort of semi-secret society, etc. You know, so much so that we still don't know for certain about a number of people, whether they're party members or not. You know, it's not necessarily public. But we know Mantashe is, for example, and he's a very powerful figure in the ANC. Some people even see him as a possible president. But look, I don't think that there is a real power base. I mean, to some extent, Kosatu, of course. Almost all the Kosatu secretaries of unions and so forth tend to be in the party. And that has been the traditional way that they, you know, they've colonized the unions, certainly at top level. I don't think that it goes much further than that now. Look, they've had a hard time. They're nothing like as strong as they were 20, 30 years ago. And it's faded a great deal. And they, as I say, they used to have some very prominent white, Indian, and colored members. Very few now that you can see. Almost none.
Bill Johnson, thank you again for inspiring.
Right now, you can get the cheapest Forex rate around, right here, on Shift. Pay less for your dollars, pounds, and euros here, and get to shop more here, and do more here, and enjoy more ooh-la-la here. Shift also lets you trade and transfer currencies, and buy shares in the world's best companies. It all happens right here, on Shift. You won't find a cheaper Forex rate anywhere else, no matter where you bank. Download the Shift app today.
In the world of business banking, projections, numbers, and your bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. That's why we understand that running a successful business takes endurance, drive, and partners who are willing to walk the journey with you. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
Downings is South Africa's leading marquee infrastructure company, proudly celebrating 25 years of excellence, renowned for creativity, innovation, and unmatched technical expertise. Our event marquees and semi-permanent structures elevate any project with style and sophistication. Whether it's a corporate event or a commercial project, we tailor every structure to meet your needs with world-class precision. Visit downings.co.za to consult with our expert team. Downings, your trusted marquee specialists nationwide.